Society
and its relationship to ecclesiastical society
in terms of the major contributions of the three members of the
Archons. Considering we saw something of Augustine, and really he laid the groundwork for the concept of civil society in the Western world, no one before his time, and in a way no one since, has done more to clarify the theology of civil society. Aquinas, I think, began by pointing out first the concept of law, which he develops, which applies, of course, to all kinds of society. Then we divided according to his terms the different kinds of law there are, the divine law, which is a broad panoramic thing, which are the divine decrees commanding that the order of the universe be observed, which observance, of course, is inevitable in the case of physical nature, is responded to freely by rational creatures. The natural law, which is man's counterpart to the divine law in his conscience. And then, particularly, positive law, which may be, as we said, either ecclesiastical or civil. And when civil, may be either state on the national level or international, if it refers to the law of nations. This, as you see, is more than just a lecture. This is a course. In fact, this is a whole science. For just a few ideas, first in terms of the significance of his concept, this is Aquinas' concept, of law, and here we are particularly concerned with civil law, as a directive of reason. First of all, Aquinas got his idea, at least on the philosophical level, from the Greeks and the Romans. I think it is at this point well to say something about the contribution of Greece and Rome to Christianity, and specifically here to the concept of civil society. Because while there have been many contributions of both cultures to Christianity, it is particularly in the concept of civil society that these two cultures contributed so much. And where, as a matter of fact, we can come to understand something of the distinctiveness of, say, the religion which we now call Christianity, which after all didn't come just full-blown from heaven. It did indeed, as a Christian believes, come from heaven and being revealed by God. Nevertheless, it came into, you might say, a vehicle, into a container. It had a mold, and to overlook, and worse still, to ignore that mold into which the faith came, is to ignore the correlative, the complement to revelation. Now, the mold into which the faith came was a society which was Greco-Roman. Just as we now talk about Judeo-Christian, so the ancient Western world spoke of itself as Greco-Roman. Now, the Greco-Romanity, so to speak, was particularly noticeable and had its major impact in terms of law and civil society. First, as regards the concept of reason itself and the function of reason in the formulation of law, this is, or was, in ancient times, a distinctively Greek idea. How do we know that? By a simple study in history. No other nation, and there were many nations contemporaneous with the Greeks, had this concept of law being thought through by the human mind in terms of a common good, so that means are taken or should be taken, and notice one more step, and that in turn would be codified in some kind of stable, what we call constitution, and not subject, and this is crucial, not subject to the whims or caprice of the individual ruler. This was true, for all practical purposes, of the world outside of the Greco-Roman world, and in large measure still is true, except where and in so far as this culture has made an impact on modern society. Now, the very word constitution, which of course we, as foreigners, say we have our idols, and among the idols is the American Constitution. I think we can become or make something of a fetish of the Constitution. Nevertheless, we do know that for us, it is that stable body of principles, at least, on which the laws of our nation should be based. Now, what is seldom recognized, the very word constitution this is simply an intensive, the prefix, an intensive. This root here is the same one for the Latin story. Something that stands, something that is stable, something that is fixed, immovable, unchangeable. Now behind that is a whole philosophy, which then Christianity came along and further elevated into a theology. Namely that where human wills can change, and change, and change radically, as we know, from morning till night, husband comes home, cannot recognize his wife. He's just a different woman. Well, she had a bad day. People change. I'm sure the same thing happens for men. The point is that human nature as such changes in terms of emotion and even will. But the mind, and this is Aquinas' analysis, the mind by definition, when it is in possession of the truth, somehow conforms to objective reality, which reality by definition, since it is based on the plan of God, has a set of stable values which don't change. And it is this which is behind the concept of law as developed by Aquinas. The mind of God, which of course is absolutely unchangeable, which is reflected in the reality that that mind produced in the world, that world then, recognized by the human mind, derives a corresponding stability from the unchanging quality of, well, the realities in the world. Human beings are human beings, and murder is bad now as it was in the time of Hammurabi. And consequently, when you develop civil society, you base civil society on law, which is really law. See, for us, it's so hard for us to step out of our skin because this is the only concept of law we've got. Fortunately, we have not lived under another concept of quotations law as, say, communism. See? That's a law too. It's based on the whim, we call it tyranny. Well, it's our prejudice, and it's understandable. See? Because for us, law is based on mind, on reason. Something which somehow conduces to the common good and based on a stable set of values. Anyhow, Aquinas, borrowing from the Greeks first, who did conceive the idea, then the Romans came along. The Romans were not speculators. They were not clods, as sometimes they're pictured as having been. No. They were very intelligent, but they were practical. Greece's genius and Rome's practicality gave to the world such culture as, and this is not a prejudice, the world has never known, outside of and until Christianity came along and used, as a matter of fact, this. Rome then stabilized this. Now this goes into multitudinous directions which we don't have time for at any rate. Roman law then, as developed in the various periods of the Republic, the very idea of a Republic, by the way, under Rome, indicates that what we now have, say, in the United States, goes all the way back. And it was through Christianity itself, and not insignificantly through the genius of a man like Aquinas, that this entered the stream of Western thought, Western theology. Now, what are some of the consequences? First, before we take them up, let's say a word about the opposite. We saw something in, say, in terms of modern times, tyrannies that are all over the world, not only under communism. You take Africa, fantastic tyrannies. In the name of freedom, they just took over and now are tyrannizing over their own people. And that's been known over the centuries. Communism is the modern symbol, you might say, of an irrational state, or a state that is not based on reason, on a constitution whose purpose is to foster the common good. But in, say, in ancient times, and say in the times of Aquinas, where he was particularly concerned about, we had a theology, in fact, which was called nominalism, that claimed that even God himself is not bound, you might say, by the dictates, or how shall we put it, by the directives of his mind, but by the dictates of his will. If he wants something to be good, it becomes good because he makes it such. And not because objectively even God himself is bound by the dictates, if you will, of his own mind. Well, what are some of the consequences of it? First of all, given this concept of law, which is based on reason, now what's reasonable about it? What is reasonable is the adaptation of means to a common end. See? So that a law is just on two counts. If the purpose which is envisioned by the law is good, and if the means taken to achieve that purpose are good. And consequently, it is reasonable, that is, a law is said to be reasonable, and we say just, to just assume the word, if it conduces to the common good. Too seldom do we realize that behind the word just, when we use it to describe law, is a more expressive term, rational. It's reasonable. It makes sense. Why? Because that should be the purpose of law, to foster the common good. Now, some of the consequences, first of all, what it does, this concept of law, and this has affected the whole of Western thought. It objectifies legal principles. Meaning what? Meaning that the principles on which the law is based, if the answer to this concept of law, will be objective in the sense of fostering something which is truly for the objective common good and not dependent on the caprice and whim of a ruler. Or, and as usually is the case, his own self-advantage. And in fact, when you come to think of it, laws become unjust when they fail to answer to that purpose, which is the fostering of the common good. Another consequence of this concept of law is the fact that it allows for, in its formulation, the coordination of many and the best qualified minds who study what is the common good. The moment you say you can state law in these objective terms, you're talking about something which can be worked out, which can be planned. You've got something to plan. Okay, for example, with our new law regarding the status of the minorities, particularly the Negro people. Yes, made into law a few days ago. Well, it was, as we know, for years debated and rather commonly assumed, we trust, by most Americans, that it would be for the common good if people like the Negroes had their rights respected and were not forbidden, say, entrance into public facilities and things like that. All right? So in terms of end, secondly, means. Well, what do we do about it? De facto, that end is not being achieved. These people are in many ways being discriminated against. What to do? All right, so we formulate a civil rights law which implements that common good. And then we make it a law. But you see, all the debate, all the discussion, all the planning was possible only because you're dealing with something outside the mind and not just something inside of some ruler's head wakes up in the morning and says, let's have a war. So they have a war. Do we want a war? Is it necessary? Are we being attacked? No, we just want a war. Why? Well, I just want to flex my muscles. And by the way, that's taking the case of Hitler. A third consequence, and this sometimes scandalizes people, yet it's a logical consequence, given the concept of law, which is a directive of reason, which is therefore objective and is subject to codification and so on, it then can be specified, refined, distinguished. In other words, you can take a law which is a directive of reason, and you can break it down, you can specify it in terms of, for example, its exact meaning. Secondly, the exceptions to the law. Third, exemptions to the law. Fourth, conditions under which the law should be observed. Fifth, qualifications under which a person is to either keep or not keep the law. And therefore, it ceases to be arbitrary. At least it shouldn't be arbitrary. And after being in vogue for a year or two, it is found that they did not anticipate enough contingencies, enough, say, situations. Somebody comes along and is, done an injustice by what looked like a good law, then an exception is made, an exemption. But always, it's only because you're dealing with something which is objective, to which the mind somehow subscribes, and not with a whim of the human will or emotion. Finally, one grave and important consequence, and this is what we said, where Augustine already mentioned it and Aquinas then developed it. Given law as a directive of reason, it immediately has a basis for interpretation of the law as applying to this or that person. So the person himself can interpret the law, either privately, if that is the nature of the law, or publicly, say through a legislative body. And finally, and along with this, you have a basis for passing judgment on the keeping or breaking of the law. In other words, here is the law. Now, if a person didn't know about it, if it is something that he should have known, he may be exempt and should be from having broken the law. If it is something which, for the common good, a person should pay a fine, even though he didn't or she didn't know, say, certain parking regulations and such like, pardon me for bringing to the feminine. But where certain things have simply got to be kept, otherwise things would go berserk, all right. But then you pass judgment on whether or not the person should keep the law. How responsible was he? Take recently, you may have noticed in the newspaper, right here on, I think, I-94, a young fellow was riding along his motorcycle and a big car smashed into him from behind and dragged him for some 260 feet. And then as his motorcycle tore away from the car and rolled over, this man kept going for another 600 feet, at least so witnesses said, the car before he finally stopped. Well, he was immediately taken and hailed for manslaughter. That is, the driver of the car, by the way, the motorcycle driver was killed. Suggesting this was more than just an accident. In other words, there's interpretation, even before the man is tried. You make certain judgments immediately because of the nature of a law as regarding, say, automobile accidents. But always the supposition is you've got something to which the mind corresponds in terms of an objective standard or norm. Now, it is impossible to overestimate the contribution of medieval scholasticism to the concept of law. Aquinas set down the principles. There were others who elaborated those principles already in the Middle Ages. But the American concept of law is based four square on that concept, as we will see in a little more detail when we take a better. Or no, a few more items as far as Aquinas' concept of law besides the significance of its being a directive of reason. Just that you will have heard it, and perhaps to pique your fancy to learn more about this. Augustine before him, but Aquinas at great length, pointed out that positive law has all its validity from the natural law, or in the case of the church, of course, the revealed law of God, but in general for the state, the natural law. Now that's crucial. By the way, when we hear the word positive law, it doesn't mean as though there is a negative law. The word is meaningless. The word positive, and it just goes to show how indispensable it is, I think, that's probably too strong, how very helpful the knowledge of a foreign language is, especially Latin and Greek. I don't know how many times in the course of my classes I recommend to the students to study Latin and Greek. In fact, since I've come here, we've started a course in Greek, for which, incidentally, two-volume course by a Jesuit confrere of mine is the textbook being used by Dr. Grundler. So you see we are on the same side of the fence in many things, certainly in Greek. But the knowledge of Latin and Greek is very useful for understanding the English. Now, positive law is distinct from the natural law, and Aquinas insists on its having to be based on the natural law to make it valid, because it is super, as it were, imposed. Right? It is superimposed above the law that nature gives us. Right? What happens? Civil society comes along and says, well, all right, the natural law says, don't steal. All right, it's the law written in the heart of every man. But knowing human nature, they figure, you gotta spill this out. Some might not consider, for example, helping themselves to what they might well consider samples in the local grocery store or the supermarket as stealing. So we'll have to spell out. And hence positive law, whose function is to clarify, specify, spell out, determine the natural law. We're speaking now of civil society. Now, by insisting on the positive law having to, and that's its nature for civil society, to spell out the natural law, it means, and this principle is worth a million dollars, it means that any positive law, which means any law of any state, which does not agree with or deviates from the natural law, is no law. Now, of course, this raises huge problems as to who's going to decide, but the principle is there. Now, it's, I think, correspondingly obvious, if enough people, not because there are so many, but because everybody agrees, this thing is crazy. And sure enough, it is. Then, they are in conscience. Now, that doesn't mean that they can just go along breaking the law, because there may be other considerations. Other people may consider it a good law. Even if I don't, I may not scandalize my, shall I say, weaker or less intelligent brother by ignoring the law or disobeying the law, even though I think it is no just law, because charity to my fellow citizen has some importance too. And it is this, by the way, where modern civil society has overlooked or ignored that distinction, or better, that definition of positive law having all its validity from the natural law, that we have a debacle, as seen in American society. such as European justice. No justice. Love against it. I'm thinking, among others, of our prohibition law, forbidding under heavy penalty. Not merely the abuse and all kinds of regulations which the state may certainly impose on the liquor traffic, but forbidding the drinking of it. Now that's, now we can examine and so on just how this thing came about, but there were forces, religious forces in the nation, that got this thing passed. And do you know this thing was passed? And that is the fact that because, and this is just for Christians, because Christians believe that civil society is divinely authorized, then Christians, otherwise than others, have a terrible sanction hanging over them to obey the civil law. And that as a consequence, the very best citizens in any state will be the good Christians. Well, there are bad Christians, obviously. And they can be veritable scoundrels. But it will be because they are bad Christians, not because they are Christians. Christianity, and this is the history of the church and of Christian religion over the centuries, has taught with St. Paul, all authority that is, comma, is from God. The only question is it legitimate authority? And one last thing. Aquinas also pointed out that insofar as the law is obeyed by individuals, society prospers. Now this is sometimes hard to see because, especially with our modern panaceas, in the last analysis, the prosperity and peace of a nation depends upon each individual's obeying the law. And you don't make people obey the law by, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, his concept of law was a bayonet behind a reluctant man's back. Yeah? If law is coercion, if you conceive of civil society as a kind of police state, you're going to have a police state, which means you're going to have criminals. And this I would like to leave with you. There are a lot of things I'd like to leave with you. This is one concept I do want to leave with you as a fruit of this class. That in Christianity, not because it's Aquinas, it's because it's Christianity, it's the Christian religion. Law is something inside of a man which he's supposed to keep. He recognizes with his conscience and he responds to internally. We obey not under coercion. We obey from conviction, from the inside. And the need, therefore, for teaching people, well, those principles, the moral and religious principles, without which they may conform, but between conformity and obedience is the difference between, you know, menagerie or a zoo and civil society. See? You can have animals conform, just whip them. But human beings are supposed to obey, and obedience is from the inside. This, by the way, the more you study our growing crime rate, we're just so, it's like our national debt. We look at the FBI statistics and we say, well, it's up 4%. Forgetting that in 10 years, 4% increase means that in 10 years, 40%. And most crimes, do you know, are committed by people under 21. Major crimes. Pardon me, let's just a little aside. Take in Chicago. Sphere of civil society. Partly created by the Renaissance, partly by the Reformation, partly by the new rising national and secular states. Bellarmine wrote at great length on the concept of civil law on political power. His most important single work on the subject is On the Laity, whose Latin title is De Laicis, L-A-I-C-I, S. L-A-I-C-I-S. The Laicis. Now the problems that were faced at that time were faced both by the church, speaking now of the Catholic Church, and by civil society. They would also be, it said, faced by the Protestant churches, who, after having severed themselves from the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, find themselves more than once in conflict with the boa constrictor, which they didn't realize they had been protected from, namely a sovereign state, and where sometimes they had been cajoled into, you might say, playing ball with the state. They soon discovered a change of pace in the behemoths that were created in Western society in powerful states, something that, well, is good for a historian to relate. At any rate, Bellarmine covered about four or five areas that I think are especially significant for us. Len, you have a question? In a way, the problem is the same as faced men like Augustine and Aquinas, except that in this case, a new entity entered the world. Over the years, as you know, before the Reformation, civil society was pretty much monarchical, reflecting, this has been said, I don't know how truly, reflecting the monarchy of the church. At any rate, monarchical society had been pretty much the stock in trade in the Western world. Yet all the while, even under the influence of a monarch, you see, in the time of Aquinas, what he had around him in civil society was a monarchy. And even in Bellarmine's time, there were still monarchies. Yet all the while, even though the king may have hereditarily, say, obtained his position, and even though it seemed like he had a certain amount of, you might see, autonomy and independence of the people, back in Aquinas' time, but especially in Bellarmine, a very careful distinction was made between the existence of authority and its exercise. We are, of course, talking about civil authority, or political, if you will. The trouble with the adjective political is that it's freighted with so many bad connotations. According to Bellarmine, and by the way, he built on the premises of his predecessors, he distinguished between the existence of that authority, which he said comes from God, as all Christianity from the time of St. Paul had always taught, in fact, Christ himself, who said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, meaning that Caesar must have authority. And if no one else, Christ, whom Christians believe to be God, said so. That then would be from God. But, and here's a significant distinction, another coming so soon on the other thing that I mentioned, what I'd like to have you keep, because it's this, I think, that makes us properly understand what a democracy, with all of its benefits and some of its problems, involves. Although the authority comes from God, the immediate recipient of that is the whole people. The community, the nation, the society receives that authority from God. But now, as is obvious, I'll read a few passages from Bellarmine. Well, all right, so the authority is vested in the people, comes from God, is vested in the whole people. But now what do we do? Given a society, it must be ordered, it must be structured. There must be the relationship of ruler and ruled, of the lawgiver and the one who is to obey the laws. And consequently, for the exercise of this, it will be someone designated by the people. Notice the sequence then in Bellarmine's political theory. All authority, as every Christian holds, comes from God. Civil authority is relative authority, therefore it must come from God. How does it come from God? It comes through the people, who in turn, for obvious reasons, may designate. And here is where the freedom comes in. First of all, they may designate whom they wish. They may designate one individual, may designate a number of people, may set a term, 4 years, 6 years, 2 years, may surround his holding of office with conditions. Then, and this is obvious, once such a person is vested with the authority which he is to exercise in the people's name, well, they can't say, well, we give you the authority, we can now do as we please. No. The assumption is that for the sake of a smooth running of a society, once having so not alienated, but lent, so to speak, authority according to the mind of the people to an individual or group of individuals, they then become, for the people, the vicegerents, the holders of God's authority. So the designation comes from the people. The authority, then, remember, this person has it from God. They don't give him the authority. They designate who is the holder of that over themselves. Yes?
This immediately implies that if somebody is ruling who is not designated by the people, but the people...
The actual implementation of that authority, so that people then are bound to obey the civil ruler and obey, frankly, as the representative of God, not because he has directly received. In fact, and at this point, we come, and with apologies, directly to grips with what was the typical concept of civil authority in the outstanding Protestant monarch of his time. I'm speaking of James I of England, with whom, by the way, Bellarmine engaged in several years long dialogue. Most of his political writings are his controversy with James I of England, who was a thoroughgoing Protestant, against whom he was arguing that there is no divine right of kings as conceived by James, but that James should be responsive to the will of the people. And of course, Bellarmine's main concern was with the persecution of the Catholics. And in fact, as he foretold, unless and until those principles are changed, nobody, including Catholics, will have a right to exercise his citizenship. And it is no coincidence, by the way, that a state, the one state that it thoroughly built into its principles of faith, the denial of Catholic concepts, had caused, until very modern times, almost 3 centuries, of the most tyrannical relationship of state to state or of man to man known to all history. I'm speaking of the relationship of England to Ireland.
About the relationship of France to the Huguenots.
These are the forms of civil society, whether monarchical or democratic or oligarchical and so on, are therefore determinable by the people. In other words, there is nothing specially divine about a democracy or otherwise about a monarchy. If the people want, now that wanting doesn't mean necessarily by vote, but if, say, over the centuries, they have been satisfied with the form of government, well, if that's what they want, provided and insofar as the ruler responds to the common good, that form of government is valid. Correspondingly, the forms of society according to Bellarmine may be changed. And by the way, by that time, changes had been made. And his special argumentation was against the strict monolithic authority exercised by James I. That's where he was mostly concerned. Thirdly, the binding power of civil law. Now, this is significant, and again, I repeat in the same context. Bellarmine writing in the early 17th century, by which time the great national churches had already been established. Pretty well. In England, in Scotland, in Scandinavia, in Denmark, in Germany, had been pretty well established. And a famous rule set up by the first the Lutheran princes and then applied, especially say by James, whose region it is, that should be also his religion. Meaning that the civil authority had the right to determine the religion of the inhabitants. That was a principle that I think we saw already. Well, probably I'm anticipating, or rather I'm thinking that you people are also taking the course in 590, which it is a pity some of you are not. Just to read those confessions of faith of the early Reformation, where this principle is, in so many words, built into the confessions of faith. The faith of a community is to be determined by the civil ruler. He determines the faith. And the problem then, of course, this raised for conscience, of conscience, for those who didn't subscribe to that religion, whether they were Catholics or simply nonconformists, Bellarmine was concerned with, and he was especially concerned with England, where by that time, by the beginning of the 17th century, there, of course, had been many Catholics who had suffered many liabilities because of the faith, including citizenship rights, but also numerous nonconformists. And the question then, whether and to what extent they must obey the ruler, even though he is against their conscience. And his answer was, uniformly, yes. Insofar as he is the ruler, he must be obeyed. And the famous statement of Edmund Campion, a Jesuit, an Oxford graduate, and by no account an agitator, just before he was beheaded, he made it both his profession of patriotism and his profession of faith. And he says, I die as one who believes in the spiritual sovereignty of the Pope, but as one who believes in the authority of the Queen. In fact, almost perhaps his last statement was a profession of allegiance to Elizabeth, who had put him to death. Now, that kind of distinction was made not only in theory, but it was paid for in blood by those who have their citizenship tested to the breaking point. The point being that civil law binds in conscience insofar as it pertains to civil matters. Question? No, no question.
Just wondering, did you say that Bellarmine was against the concept of having faith that can be determined by a civil ruler?
Yes. Yes. In the sense that, in other words, the faith of a person is to be determined by his conscience. By his conscience. And by the way, Bellarmine was not only concerned with Catholics, because by this time in England, which had become a thoroughly national church, but that is certainly by the beginning of the 17th century, there were numerous nonconformists. In fact, it was because, incidentally, it was because of the nonconformity that our American colonies were founded. Yes.
Let's assume that in Spain that Franco turns the rule, civil rule, over to
class on Friday. Is it Friday or Thursday?
Thursday.
On the church and state relations, the issue there, of course, was the relationship, mainly, of course, of the Catholic Church to a state which had been either secularized or mainly had become a national church. And a principle was invoked there of how far the church's authority extends to the citizens, so they are not faced with the option of choosing between the church or the state. We'll elaborate on that in the next class. Wesley, and specifically in his famous Way of Salvation, which sometimes has also been called the Way of Perfection, it is the best known of Wesley's treatises. I have a little critical edition of it, come out in a, I think it's in paperback too, The Way of Salvation. How far have we got?
Page 64
on the concept of faith. Good. Remember we were saying that among Wesley's contributions to the, well, the spirit of Protestantism was a reevaluation of the concept of faith as merely assurance. Can you read this? It's usually hard to erase these things. So, according to Wesley, we should look upon both sides of St. Paul's definition of faith. You remember he says it is the substance of things to be hoped for and the evidence of things unseen. In Wesley's judgment, the Reformers, mainly Calvin and Luther, had done scant justice to the second part. They had so stressed the element of assurance as to have overlooked, if not denied, the element of adherence. Consequently, the first has to do somehow with hope, the substance of hope. And the second, he says, is evidence of, well, things unseen, things revealed. Now, without elaborating, a very complex subject in theology, my regular courses was a semester course, a little less, about 3.5 months. 4 classes a week plus a seminar on just the concept of faith. We spend a treatise called De Fide. But at least summarily, in the Reformers, and you see this coming up time and again, especially in the concept of justification, when they said that a man is justified by faith and faith alone, while the term faith is the same as semantically it would for, say, a Catholic and a Protestant, I'm speaking of now the pre-Wesleyan Protestant, see? It would be that confidence, the assurance that I have that I am one of the saved, that Christ's merits have indeed been imputed to me, and that my own sins have been covered over by the blood of Christ. Wesley does not deny that. He affirms, however, that there is more to it than that. And then he adds what is quite unreformed in placing a priority on adherence as the basis for assurance. Let's read at least a passage or two. He asks, this is in section 3. In part 2, we are not talking about how a person gets saved. First was his concept of salvation. Secondly, it is through faith, and he's analyzing this concept of faith. And he asks, but is this faith of assurance or faith of adherence? No, he says, the scripture mentions no such distinction, meaning that scripture does not allow you to say it is the one and not the other, which, by the way, had been pretty much the motto, as you will find when you read Calvin, for example, of the classic reformers. Namely, faith is only of assurance. And while there may be adherence to what? Adherence to a body of doctrine, adherence to certain things that are revealed, adhesion of the mind, say, to objective reality, that men like Calvin admitted might well be there. They denominated historical faith, which may be there, but that is not what saves. What saves is uniquely assurance, which you have. Christ's grace coming into and assuring you that you are saved. That's it. Not your prior knowledge or subscription to a body of revealed doctrine. The apostle says there is one faith and one hope of our calling. Then he goes on, and it is particularly the last two lines, two sentences, which are, frankly, in their statement, Catholic teaching. For a man cannot have a childlike confidence in God. This, by the way, I would say deserves to be memorized. Why? Because it is, and as we've been saying more than once, in studying these creeds, the purpose was to study the pure streams, as it were. Right? Now here's another one of the major streams. This stream has affected all Protestant thinking. For a man cannot have a childlike confidence in God, which was the motto of the Reformation. See? It is this confidence of God, in God, in Christ's mercy, in your sins having been covered over, which saves you. If you've got that, you're saved. If you don't, unfortunately, you're not one of the people. If you were, you would have that confidence. Then he says, a man cannot have such childlike confidence in God till he knows that he is a child of God. Therefore, and what a therefore, confidence, trust, reliance, adherence now in the sense, the word means adherence to, say, to Christ's mercy, or whatever else it is called, he is not the first, as some have supposed, but the second branch or act of faith. Now you'll notice in the course of the paragraph, he interlards the concept, the meaning of assurance and adherence. And he is a little misleading just where he is saying which. But basically, a person, at least in one set of doublets, a person may be said to have assurance if he accepts the doctrines, the teachings of Christ. He must first therefore know with his mind before his hope be in God's mercy or in Christ's redemption can have meaning for him. And therefore, this faith, and by the way, St. Paul gives plenty of warrant for this kind of assurance, but the very fact that he calls it the substance of hope gives Wesley a chance to tell you that it is the foundation of that hope. It is not the hope itself. It is the substratum, the foundation, the basis for the confidence. And here too, or better, because of this, you don't see, we cannot perspicaciously understand the truths of Revelation. They wouldn't be mysteries. If I can, some morning, wake up and give a lucid exposition of the inner meaning of the Trinity, I have dissolved the mystery. I no longer believe. I now know. Nevertheless, when I believe, I still adhere in my mind to what God has said on his word. And it is this adherence of the mind, this acceptance by the mind, so this is the mind's acceptance, which gives me the ground for this hope. So it is the substance, the basis of my hope. The evidence, in other words, my faith supplies for the evidence that I would have in ordinary, say, scientific inquiry, experimentation. I can prove to my mind, for example, the business of, say, the right triangle, the square and the hypotenuse being equal to the square of the sums of the other two sides, and so on, all kinds of things that are part of natural science. I can come to understand and say, I got it. Well, in matters of faith, I don't have that kind of evidence. This is evidence, if you will, which God's word supplies for the things that he revealed, which I cannot see. The evidence of things unseen, which is what revealed things are. They are unseen to the natural mind. The mind cannot comprehend them. Nevertheless, the mind first accepts them. And therefore, we say, speaking now as a Catholic, with Wesley, that faith is first adherence of the mind to God's revelation, and then becomes the basis or the foundation for my hope or confidence. And the only reason that I can trust that Christ's mercy is indeed infinite and that it gives me hope of salvation is because I first believe there is a God, I believe there is a Christ, I believe that he died with my mind. It is not just a kind of a feeling. It is something which has some substance to it. Anyhow, this, if nothing else, had been written by Wesley, that single paragraph would have changed the course of at least English-speaking Protestantism, as it did. Yes, John?
I was just checking another creedal statement, Reformed Church, which has...
That which really justifies. See, after all, there's a difference, isn't there, between having the faith and speaking of that faith as functionally justifying you. See? And when you come to that big question, the root question, what justifies faith and faith alone? Well, what does that mean? Now, in the classic reformers, in Luther and Calvin, Luther perhaps more on the confident side than Calvin, nevertheless both,
they would say what justifies is not my knowledge.
Because, as Calvin said, and Luther before him, the devil believes and he certainly is not justified.
No, I was not quoting Calvin.
No. Well, what I would say is, in other words, your own Reformed creed as of now, therefore, you speak of the Reformed Church of America, has been affected and understandably.
Rightly so.
Please?
Rightly so.
Yes. In other words, there was a balance put in which, well, many thought was a long time coming. Wesley, after all, came in the fairly late, considering the antiquity of some of those creeds. In fact, it was already in the continent way before, in, say, the whole Arminian tradition. And there, by the way, it would be interesting if you could get yourself a copy of the Confession of Faith of the Christian Reformed Church. You would find the wording, at least, is quite different. Much less compromising.
This is the one I was just quoting, sir.
Christian Reformed.
Yes, I was just quoting. The Heidelberg Catechism.
Oh.
Not only a sure knowledge, but also a hearty confidence.
Yeah. I was just thinking maybe it might be, you're not speaking of the Reformed Church of America, using the Heidelberg.
I just heard from the writings of Ursinus.
Yeah, but I know I'm speaking of the present modern-day Christian Reformed Church, John.
Yes, sir.
Christian Reformed.
Yes, I happen to be a member of the church.
But not the Reformed Church of America.
No.
Which is it, John?
Which one am I quoting?
Yes.
I think the Heidelberg is probably accepted by both.
No, what I mean is, what church do you belong to?
Oh,
Christian Reformed. Well, if even the Christian Reformed has it, well, because that, as you probably know, is much more dogmatically, you might say, constant and traditional than the Reformed Church, which is much more liberal. See? You would expect it's the Reformed Church of America. If you have it,
then it would show how, see, some of the early ideas about faith and faith alone in the sense of being that trust alone which saves.
Was that creed written?
Please?
Heidelberg Catechism was in the 17th century.
Well, that's over 100 years plus.
Anyhow,
there is a change. So, this gives you an idea of how you might say...
These are things, again, without being known, the ecumenical movement really is unintelligible. It looks like some politicians or the international bankers getting together and figuring by getting the churches organized, there might be more money in it. You know, it looks suspicious. This is something which has been going on for hundreds of years. In other words, a shifting of emphasis, a change of position from the hard and fast absolute predestinarianism of St. Calvin. Now, on page 366,
just to refer once more to something
we're going to talk about, and wherein, as a matter of fact, Wesley finds himself in a kind of, dilemma. On the one hand, he doesn't want to depart from his Protestant tradition. On the other hand, he doesn't want to, you might say, completely accept the belief in a free will as understood in, say, Roman Catholicism, at any rate. You'll notice the stress there in 3 now. He is going to examine, remember his 3 questions, he's going to examine, how are we saved by it? How does this faith work? And first he says, how are we justified by faith? And I answer, faith is the condition and the only condition of justification. It is the condition. None is justified but he that believes. Without faith, no man is justified. And it is the only condition. This alone is sufficient for justification. But by that time, he has already redefined the faith. So while he is repeating the motto of the Reformation, see, it is already a changed motto. Everyone that believes is justified, whatever else he has or has not. In other words, no man is justified till he believes. Every man, when he believes, is justified.
That's the universal
Calvin wouldn't buy that.
Please?
Calvin wouldn't buy that.
No.
He would have to be, well, at least he would admit, I think, that a person could possibly, well, depending on what part of the Institute you're dealing with, predestination, see, is the mark of a person being justified, and if he seems to be justified and he's not predestined, then his faith or belief is spurious.
In other words, there's much more responsibility on the part of a
man here than there would be in Calvin.
Even Luther, would Luther justify this, making faith the ground, the condition?
No, even he wouldn't. Even he wouldn't, because what you are practically saying, at least so Wesley can be interpreted as saying, there is something in man which, quotes, causes justification. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
In other words, there was a shift here from that sovereignty of God to man somehow contributing to the ongoing function of salvation, which is a bit strange to classic Protestants. Okay?
Didn't this idea originate with Wolebus and Zonkey? They had the same types of idea.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say necessarily originated. I would say it originated with medieval scholasticism. See? Yeah. In other words, in their analysis, you're speaking of the scholastics, the Protestant scholastics. When they came to analyze the faith, see, that's what they did.
After the first, you might say, first flush of the Reformation had passed, that is the change of emphasis, then they began to ask themselves, now what is this faith?
And justification by faith alone. And in their analysis, they used at least the terminology, if not the concepts, even of the medieval scholastics.
Well, they'd all been educated in the scholastics.
Scholastic tradition, and particularly the importance of the intellects, see, somehow controlling the will. You will, or you trust, and trust after all is an act of the will, only insofar as you know. Your knowledge controls your will. But now in the middle of the page
366
is something which
Wesley is, as you know,
always tantalizing.